the Abominator has decided that he would escalate airstrikes. Now, these are bombings now of the community of Kobani. Now, whether the Islamic State takes over Kobani or not is really immaterial. And right now they control about 80% of the city. There's really no one left in Kobani. The issue with Kobani really is the destabilization of Turkey, because the population of Kobani is now in Turkey. And because it's right there on the border, it's one of the border crossings into to Turkey. It was one of the many places where jihadists would cross into Syria from Turkey. And so the risk now associated with Kobani has nothing to do with the Islamic State. It has all to do with the increasing number of irate Kurds in Turkey and the destabilization of that country. Now, I'm not a fan of Turkey. I know Turkey is a NATO member, but Turkey has become fundamentalist Islamic. It only has a pretense now of democracy. It's overwhelmingly fundamentalist. And the fundamentalists do not care what Erdogan does. Erdogan could go bomb the Kurds and they applaud. Erdogan can send his own military in to squelch and attack and terrorize those who speak out against the Islamic regime that he has imposed. And they applaud. Erdogan and his sons can skim tens of millions of dollars on away from the citizens of the country and line their own pockets, and they don't care. It doesn't matter what he does. He can imprison journalists, and the world yawns. He imprisons his generals, and the world yawns. He lies regarding Israel, the world applauds. I do not care what happens to Turkey. Turkey isn't salvageable at this point. But you need to put that into your calculus as you're evaluating this region that, since America has elected to engage, making the situation volatile in Turkey is counterproductive to what America is doing. In other words, this whole engagement against the Islamic State and arming the Kurds was unbelievably inflammatory as it relates to Turkey. And Turkey is a NATO ally. And so, while my solution to the whole region is to isolate it, to disengage, that's the opposite approach that America has taken. And the approach that America has taken has been consistently counterproductive, literally suicidal. So yesterday, as the Abominator was meeting with his military, trying to figure out what we're going to do, he walked out of the meeting saying, you know, I realize the situation's bad, and it's gotten worse, and that we've had nothing but setbacks so far. The war on the militants in Syria is threatening to unravel a very bad situation in Turkey, and the Abominator knows it. America doesn't want to cover it, but the Kurds that have escaped from northern Syria are now rioting throughout Turkey. I mean, there's 15 million Kurds in Turkey. Turkish warplanes were reported to have bombed Kurdish rebel targets in southeast Turkey just these last few days. So Turkey, which is forbidding America to use its air bases to launch strikes against the Islamic State, is using American warplanes to bomb the Kurds. America is engaging the Kurds and arming the Kurds to go fight the Islamic State, while the Turkish government is saying, no, you can't do that, but we're going to use American warplanes to bomb the very Kurds that America is equipping. I mean, talk about a tangled web. An absolute mess. That's what we've created in Iraq. And it all stems from basic denial and duplicity, hypocrisy. It all stems from the degrading character of America's leadership and our incapacity to think morally and rationally. It's all a direct result of us not understanding cause and consequence and how our invasion of Iraq, which was based on a pile of lies and then was promoted with even more lies, made a very bad situation worse. And that the world, America specifically, and the world generally, would have been much better off, especially Iraqis, especially Syrians, would have been vastly better off had America not invaded Iraq. But by invading Iraq, all of the rest of this is unraveled. It's our responsibility. We broke these countries. And we can't fix it by continuing to bomb. That is what got us into this problem in the first place. You know how many Kurds, Turkish warplanes, and Turkish artillery have murdered over the past 3 decades? 40,000. 40,000 is how many Kurds that America's NATO ally, Turkey, have killed in their own country using American war equipment. And so now America arms the Kurds with very powerful weapons to go after the Islamic State. And America can't figure out why the Turks aren't allowing America to use its bases. There has been a bombing run, multiple runs, on the Kurds in eastern Turkey. And artillery fired by the Turkish Republic Army against the Kurds every day for almost 30 years. And we have exacerbated that. And there's deadly riots, looting taking place across Turkey now. I mentioned this briefly, but I'd like to share the story with you. The U.S. Holocaust Museum director says that graphic photos showing the corpses of Syrian torture victims reveal a systematic killing machine that's reminiscent of the images from the Nazi concentration camps. In a chilling and potentially controversial exhibit that opens Wednesday, the museum will put on display for the first time photographs smuggled out of Syria by a regime defector that show the emaciated and burned bodies of suspected dissidents believed to have been tortured and then killed in government detention centers. The photos demonstrate the human indifference and depravity of the Assad regime, said Cameron Hudson, a former White House national security official under the President George W. Bush regime, who now serves as the director of the Holocaust Museum. The photos show that this is methodical, that it's organized, and that it's a campaign that's going on across the country. What the Assad regime would have you believe is that these are all combatants, that they are battlefield deaths, and that they're fighting a civil war. But that's not what the pictures reveal. These pictures are gruesome. I've seen many hundreds of the thousands. There's only so much you can witness of these pictures before you become nauseated. They are emaciated bodies. I mean, men's bodies that are sprawled out as like cordwood that are simply skin and bones. They've been starved to death. There are men with their eyes gouged out. There are men with grotesque bruises from blunt implement torture on their chest, their backs, their feet. This is savagery at the level of Roman Catholicism during the Inquisition. this is savagery worse than the Holocaust. Now, it's not worse than the Holocaust in terms of numbers of people starved and worked to death. It's not worse than the Holocaust in terms of the numbers of people gassed by the Nazis. I mean, that was millions. And women and children were not immune. But the Nazis, while they did engage in torture, didn't routinely torture. You know, the gas chambers, you know, it's despicable that millions of women, children, and men, elderly, were put through them. But it's not a means of torture. These pictures show systematic torture. And so the Assad regime, the regime that America is now bombing on behalf of in Syria, is among the most heinous dictatorships ever imposed on a nation. These are tens of thousands of individuals tortured to death by the Assad regime, and them gloating about it by taking photographs of it. You might say, well, boy, then America was really right and arming the rebels who were opposed to the Assad regime. You might think so, until you realize what those rebels are all about. They're the ones that kidnap 5-year-old girls and sell them as sex slaves. They're the ones conducting the decapitations. They're the ones that say, convert to Islam or die. They're the ones that have annihilated the entire Christian populations of both countries. They're worse. That's how depraved the world of Islam is. That you have a dictator who has photographed the systematic torture of tens of thousands of his own citizens. And he's better than those opposing him. That's why I say that if you actually examine the results of Islam, the consequence of Islam, isolating Muslims, disengaging from the Islamic world, quarantining Islam, is the by far the wisest and most merciful thing we can do as human beings. I don't want to give the impression that there are hundreds of pictures. I've told you that I've looked at hundreds of pictures. And when these pictures were first released to the media, I endured hundreds of them. I don't know, maybe 150, 200. And it's horrifying. It's much worse than just a sea of bodies, naked, stretched out over vast expanses, starved to death, beaten, tortured. The signs of torture and the close-up shots of the torture are just nauseating. This is what Islam does. There are actually 27,000 photographs. 27,000 of them. So here we are as America. We have two fake videos showing alleged beheadings. And we declare war against the Islamic State. And yet here's 27,000 photographs of absolute certain mass torture, sadistic mass murder. 27,000 photographs, many that have 20, 30, 40, 50 victims in a single photograph, whose authenticity is absolutely unquestioned. And we fight on behalf of that regime. That's how far America has fallen morally. Now, the answer is not to go bomb Assad and to kill this ruthless dictator, because the regime that would take over would be a would be the Islamic State, and that would be worse. But to fight on behalf of the Assad regime that is perpetrating this horror by bombing their only tangible foe, the Islamic State, is even worse. There are times when doing nothing is the right thing, just as it is with Ebola. Quarantining existing Ebola victims is the most merciful thing you can do. The same thing is true with Islam. I don't know if we're to the place in America or in the West where the majority of people can put these things together, put the pieces together to understand how America created this mess through its invasion of Iraq and how the deployment of the U.S. military has been counterproductive, and that the U.S. government at the highest level is almost always making the wrong call, doing the wrong thing for the wrong reasons and lying about it. And then what is the natural consequence of that? What should you as an individual do once you're aware of that? In this case of these pictures, the defector who brought the photos to the West using thumb drives that he concealed in his shoes is a former Syrian military police photographer. He worked for the regime in Syria. He goes by the name of Caesar. According to the account he has given the investigators, he had headed a team assigned to photograph the bodies of Syrians brought into a military hospital after they had died at one of just three of scores of detention centers around Damascus. 27,000 photographs. So what motivated him to defect and bring with him such damning evidence of the very regime that he was working for? He says it became personal. He started recognizing people from his village whom he knew were not combatants, but simply victims. In many cases, they were women and children. In other words, the Assad regime was torturing for the thrill of torture. That's how far people can fall. By not understanding that there are diseases that the only moral response is to quarantine, by bringing in a Liberian who knew he had Ebola, who lied to transportation authorities about his contacts with Ebola, who made his own family and healthcare workers susceptible to Ebola, we now find that a second Texas healthcare worker has been diagnosed with Ebola. All of the promises that we received from the CDC in the hospital that we are on top of this, we know how it's transmitted, we'll stop it in its tracks, proved to be untrue, didn't they? Going back 5-6 months ago, when the United States economy was reported in the doldrums, and it was all blamed on a abnormally cold winter. And they said, oh, it's just this, it's just a result of it being too cold for people to shop, and they stayed at home, and this is an anomaly. We're in the midst of the Obama recovery. You just don't worry. As soon as it warms up, everything will be back to normal. And I said, no, that's not the case. And they then reported the next quarter where we were in spring conditions, and they said, see, we told you. And it wasn't was way below forecasts. And then they revised all of those numbers down and said, well, maybe we misreported that information. And now? Well, U.S. retail sales declined. They actually declined in September. It's not that we have anemic growth, just as we had in the first quarter. The economy is contracting. Business prices the wholesale price index also contracted. Total retail sales dropped by 0.3%. Now, you might say 0.3% is meaningless, but it's a drop. You know, with having inflated the money supply by trillions of dollars, just inflation alone should be running at 8, 9, 10%. And yet, retail sales dropped. It's a slowing of the U.S. economy. What came as more of a surprise was the drop in core sales, which strip out automobiles, which, by the way, everybody was touting, oh, boy, the great recovery, you know. No, automobile sales are in the doldrums. Gasoline, building materials, and food services, and correspond with the consumer spending component of the gross domestic product, which is 70% of the total. And economists had expected that to increase, but it fell as well. Producer prices, that wholesale price index, through this point last year, had risen 1.6%, which was the lowest rise, showing really of a sluggish, if not contracting, almost contracting economy. And yet, now it's falling. This is a serious problem. That's one of the reasons why the stock market has had such a dismal couple of weeks. Fundamentals in America are really screwed up. We grossly overtax corporations, amongst the worst in the world, in our tax rate for corporations. Corporations shouldn't be taxed at all. They really shouldn't be taxed at all. They create jobs. They create income. They create product. The smartest thing we could do for our economy and for prosperity of America is to stop taxing corporations entirely. And then we would be vastly better if we got rid of the Internal Revenue Service and imposed strictly a value-added tax. Everybody pays their fair share based upon what you buy. The more you buy, the more you pay. But it doesn't matter then if you're an illegal alien or a citizen. You go to buy something, you pay the same tax everybody pays. No cheating. No jury rigging. No playing around. But we won't do that as a country. This is an interesting story. Montgomery, Alabama is the dateline. Less than a week after a pastor was ousted amid a heated controversy after he admitted that he had sex with female church members while knowing that he had AIDS. He led the Sunday services at Shiloh Missionary Baptist Church. Now, if you were in that congregation, if you are in any way responsible for the Shiloh Missionary Baptist Church, you ought to be disgusted. You ought to have your head examined. But yet a fervent congregation of around 50 sang loudly and encouraged Pastor Juan McFarland throughout his sermon. Yes, this is the man who had sex with women in the congregation knowing that he had AIDS. Yeah, boy, you tell him there, Pastor. The pastor appeared full of the Spirit, the witnesses said. On Wednesday, retired Shiloh deacon Nathan Williams said McFarland had admitted in September during a church service that he was HIV positive. He followed that, said Williams, with a more stunning confession, including that he was diagnosed with AIDS in 2008 and had sexual interactions with numerous church members. He even took illegal drugs. And he misappropriated church funds. Yeah, Pastor, you tell him. Come on, man, you deliver that sermon. You're filled with the Spirit. After the debacle, church leaders voted 80-2 to oust McFarland from the church. The news made national headlines. For some visitors to the church on Sunday, they greeted McFarland, would abuse them so badly, with smiles. McFarland, who has been to Shiloh's pastor, who had been for 24 years, referenced the biblical stories of the power of prayer, power of prayer. There's no power of prayer. And God's ability to provide sudden healing. Themes that reflected his own dilemma. Yahweh heals his covenant children. He does not heal Christians. He focused on the story in the book of Matthew. It's actually Matanyah. In which a faithful centurion calls upon Jesus to heal his servant who was dying of leprosy. There's nothing that indicates the centurion is faithful. And the purpose of the story isn't the healing of the servant. It's an afterthought. Purpose of that story is to show that Yahusha is capable of redeeming the soul. And the individual is only healed of a physical stigma to underscore the importance of healing the soul. But this man's soul was not healed. Jesus did it suddenly from the congregation. A voice called out, "Preach it, Reverend." Now, there is no Jesus. Sometimes the worst times in our lives, he said, are when we have a midnight situation and we are in a midnight situation, McFarland told churchgoers. We are in. No. This is a dark, demented soul. He misappropriated church funds. He used illegal drugs. He got AIDS by either using those drugs or by having unprotected sex. And then he had sex with church members as their pastor, taking advantage of that role. And he gave them AIDS. The midnight situation is what happened to your soul. When you pray, you've got to forgive. Well, you shouldn't be praying, and you don't have to forgive. There's no reason to forgive him. Yahweh's not going to forgive him. And we aren't in the business of forgiveness. Not as individuals. It's the business of choosing who he's going to forgive and who he's going to condemn is God's alone. Not mine, not yours. I can't influence whether or not someone who is listening to this program is going to be forgiven or condemned. All I can tell you is what Yahweh said about what would cause someone to be forgiven and what would cause someone to be condemned. And I can tell you that what he says has nothing to do with prayer. That it most certainly has nothing to do with getting down on your knees. So this pastor lied. He said, you can't go down on your knees hating somebody or wishing something bad will happen to somebody. You ought not go down on your knees at all, and you should hate. You should hate. Everybody in that congregation should hate this man. He not only stole from you, he preyed upon the women in the congregation. He gave them AIDS. You should hate him. Those are despicable things that he did. You ought not embrace him. You ought not welcome him back into your company. You ought to despise him. What he did was despicable. That's real. In fact, you're incapable of loving if you do not hate those who victimize those you love. That's why Yahweh talks about him being jealous, zealous. That's why he is so antagonistic against the perpetrators of religion and such diseases as this. If you do not hate those who are threatening harm, real, genuine harm to those you love, then you aren't capable of love. You ought to hate him. Now, Yahweh has a very distinct way of deciding who he's going to save. Very clear about it. If you want to be forgiven, then you need to come to know Yahweh, and you need to come to understand the terms and conditions of participating in his covenant, of which there is only one, meaning that you can throw away the Christian New Testament, because there is no New Testament. There is no renewed covenant. There's only one. And you can embrace those terms and conditions. You can agree to them. And the means to salvation that is then provided to the covenant's children begins with an observation of Pesach, Passover, matzah, unyeasted bread, which removes the fungus of sin, religious and political sin from our souls. Bukurim, where we're adopted into Yahweh's covenant family as his children. Shavuah, where we are enriched and empowered on the promise of this Shabbat. Leading to Teruah, where we shout out to this message to anyone who would listen. And Yom Kippurim, where we come into the presence of Yahweh's maternal light so that we can celebrate. And today, at sunset, is the eighth day of Sukkot. Since being voted out, McFarland has retained the keys to the church building. He is still in complete control over the church finances. Finances that he misappropriated. If you look at the sign out in front of the modern building that represents this church, his name is still listed as the pastor. McFarland, as he returned as the preacher, broke out in song as he stepped down the aisles where the congregants, most of them in tears, embraced him and shook his hand while they all sang, "The Lord my God is my sovereign." That's true. The Lord is their God, and he is sovereign in their lives. It's too bad they don't know that the Lord is Satan. Geneva is the dateline of this next story. We've hinted at some of this in previous programs, but there's just something very odd about this Ebola outbreak. The death rate in the Ebola outbreak is now being presented at 70%. When I began telling this story, Ebola's death rate was about 90%. And then it, for a very long time, was 70%. And I continued to use the 70% number, and then there were new stories that said, no, it's fallen to 50%. And it stayed at 50% for 2 or 3 weeks, and now they're saying, no, it's back up to 70%. And I'm telling you, the lower the death rate is on this disease, the harder it's going to be to ultimately constrain, because there's that feeling that if I take care of my family member, my loved one, and I don't turn him over to one of these facilities where they're isolated, that they may survive. And the higher the death rate, the more people are going to be willing to say, you know, I don't want you infected with this disease that's killing me. Stand away. There's no reason we should all die. The World Health Organization, which is part of the United Nations director, gave these grim figures, saying that he expected that there would be up to 10,000 new cases a week within 2 months. Well, if there's going to be 10,000 cases a week, you know, at this point, about 4,500 people have died of Ebola. And with a fatality rate of 70% and 10,000 cases per week, that would be 7,000 deaths per week. You'd almost have 2 times more people dying per week, if he's right, than have died since the Ebola outbreak began seven, eight, 9 months ago. I doubt that he's right. But if he's right, then all you would have to do is to say, what's changed since that time? What's changed is the world's response. Prior to it escalating, it was a Liberian issue. And smart people quarantined that area. It was a Guinea issue. It was a Sierra Leone issue. But what's changed that would escalate the numbers is that the world is trying to deal with it and is sending in resources and personnel, particularly the United States, which has sent in 4,000 troops. It is our unwillingness to quarantine the disease. This is the problem. The World Health Organization says that 8,900 people thus far have been infected with Ebola, where 4,447 have died. Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia have been the hardest hit nations. But this is the statement that that is just unconscionable if you're a rational person. The head of the World Health Organization said, it would be horrifically unethical to say that we're just going to isolate people. He said, noting that new strategies like handing out protective equipment to families and setting up basic clinics without much treatment was a priority. Amazing. The only intelligent, the only moral, the only compassionate, the only wise approach to Ebola is to isolate the people with Ebola. That's it. There's no cure for this disease. It transmits via contact. Isolation, quarantine. If isolation and quarantine had been deployed, the death toll of Ebola would have been in the tens, maybe 100, and it would be over by now. But because ethics has changed, now thousands have died, and they're saying that tens of thousands will die, all because we're being unethical.